Hi, and welcome to the virtual studio for the Global Summitry Project. My name is Alan Alexandroff, and I am the director of the Global Summitry Project. You can find our research activities at globalsummitryproject.com. It includes our three podcast series, Shaking the Global Order, Summit Dialogue, and the Now series. And it also does focus on our research activities, the China and the West Dialogue, CWD project, and also our focus on achieving the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs. It is my pleasure today to bring into the virtual studio Bruce Jones, and this is Shaking the Global Order, Season 2, Episode 18. The U.S.-China relationship has been marked by growing competition and rivalry, and we wanted to explore the current state of U.S.-China relations as a result of the summit that the leaders held back in November at the margins of the APEC summit itself. That is the meeting between Xi Jinping and Joe Biden. And we wanted to examine what the consequences of that meeting have brought to U.S.-China relations. And it's, of course, my pleasure, as I mentioned, to introduce to you Bruce Jones. He is a senior fellow with the Strobe Talbot Center for Security, Strategy, and Technology in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He also works with the Center for East Asia Policy Studies. From 2015 to 2020, Bruce served as the Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. Bruce has written extensively. His most recent book is To Rule the Waves, How Control of the World's Ocean Shapes the Fate of the Superpowers. He's also had significant experience in multilateral institutions. He was senior advisor to Kofi Annan on UN reform and served as Deputy Research Director to the UN's high-level panels on threats, challenges, and change, as well as a lead scholar for the International Task Force on Global Public Goods. So let's bring Bruce into the virtual studio to examine the U.S.-China relationship and relations between the two in the broader Indo-Pacific environment. So welcome, Bruce. It's a pleasure to have you with us in the virtual studio.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great. Okay, so Bruce, I wanted to start with the meeting that took place between Xi Jinping and Joe Biden, which was at the margins of the APEC summit in San Francisco in November. And I guess I'm wondering how you saw, you know, kind of the results of that summit.
Well, I've been an advocate of an effort to resume what I've talked about as guardrails in the relationship, right? We were in this long period of time where there weren't high-level dialogues or there were no military-to-military channels. Pretty worrying, given the state of play between the two countries. I think the Xi-Biden meeting helped in restoring some guardrails. There were other factors at play. The most bizarre one is this whole saga of the Chinese defense minister who had been under sanctions by the United States, which had been a significant roadblock to the reemergence of military ties. That guy has been disappeared from public life by Mr. President Xi. So here we are, and we're now able to resume military. I don't know what, you know, the balance between his disappearance and the Xi-Biden meeting was, but anyway, the two have combined to allow for the restoration of military-to-military ties, which is good. I think it helps. I think the Biden-Xi meeting sort of put a bit of a sort of cooled down some of the rhetorical escalation for some time. But I don't think it does anything to change the fundamentals, and I don't think either Xi or Biden believe it does anything to change the fundamentals, and I don't think anybody in the administrations of either country believe it did anything to change the fundamentals, nor was it designed to change the fundamentals, right? These are two countries who see each other now as rivals and are engaged in rivalry, commercial and strategic. Neither of them particularly wants accidental escalation into conflict. So the guardrails are useful. I think it remains to be seen to what extent it changes really any aspect of either side's behavior in sort of practical terms in the Western Pacific. But it's certainly an important step in terms of avoiding accidental escalation and sort of a crisis at sea that spirals out of control, which is a very real possibility.
Okay, fair enough. I did want to raise Evan Medeiros's report. This is titled The New Domestic Politics of U.S.-China Relations. He published it with the Asia Society, concluded that the changes in China's domestic politics create and sustain incentives to see the United States as a long-term strategic and ideological adversary. And these implications of the changes in Chinese politics for U.S. relations are substantial and accumulating. I wonder, do you, generally agree with that? And if so, what are the consequences in terms of U.S.-China relations going forward?
Yeah, so you may remember that a few years ago, I started a process together with several of my colleagues at Brookings and the Kicker Institution.
Yes. Yep.
And our point of view at the time, both sides, was that we had the relationship between the two countries had crossed a threshold and that we were now rivals in a strategic sense, commercially and in military terms. We were rivals, and that rivalry had to be managed. And that was a function of economics, a function of geography, a function of a whole set of factors, and internal politics. So I've been of the view for some time that the internal politics of both countries, and it's not just of China, it's also the United States, the internal politics amplify the rivalry. But I think it's kind of fundamental factors that drive it. In other words, you could have a slight change in the politics of Beijing and a slight change in the politics of Washington, and it wouldn't change the fundamentals. But it's certainly the case that the internal politics of both sides amplify the tensions. I mean, just put it this way. Mm-hmm. We envision any American successfully running for election and being elected who has a largely benign view of China. I mean, you can't think of a single person in the political landscape who has even remotely a chance to become president of the United States who looks at China in a benign way. So we have zero sort of sources of politics in the United States pushing in that direction. And I think it's true, abundantly true in China as well.
But so benign is out, but I mean, is it, can we see a kind of broadly nuanced perspective, looking here at the United States and its political leadership in terms of its relationship with China? I mean, is that a possibility, or are we looking just at, rivalry confined to some degree by the guardrails that you talked about?
Because American foreign policy is so good at nuance. Is that Look, this is a country full of smart people and administration and military, and I think they have a very nuanced understanding of what China is. There are a lot of smart people in Beijing who have a pretty nuanced understanding of what Washington is. So I don't think this is some, this is not the rhetoric you get out of some people in Congress. This is not the rhetoric that you hear in the kind of on the right. And that's not what I'm referring to. Mm-hmm. But the people with subtle understandings of Beijing see their ambitions and see those ambitions as consequential in a negative way for the United States and vice versa, right? Mm-hmm. The things that it is natural for China to want to do next are things that are not particularly good for the United States in its kind of global posture. So you don't have to be, that's not, you don't have to have an unnuanced view of China to think that a lot of what China is doing or China's going to do is problematic for the United States and for others, not just the United States. I think we're also watching a phase in which the region has amplified its degree of concern about China. We're seeing increased defense spending in Korea and Japan and Australia, et cetera, et cetera. We're seeing a kind of an arms race in the region. So there are just all sorts of reasons to be worried, and it's not for lack of nuance. That doesn't mean we should look at China as an enemy. It doesn't mean there aren't things we can do with the Chinese, et cetera. But I worry when I hear people suggest that thinking of China as a rival or thinking of the relationship in terms of rivalry comes out of a kind of, you know, unsophisticated view of Beijing or something like that. I just don't think that's true. I think it comes out of a clear-eyed understanding of what Beijing is up to and how they plan to get there.
And sorry, just so we are clear about this, what is Beijing up to? Looking, let's say, at the Indo-Pacific in particular, because that's clearly, you know, the home territory, so to speak. So what is it that we're looking to see vis-a-vis China?
Yeah, I think there are sort of a few things that they're trying to get done. And again, perfectly legitimate seen from their point of view, but that doesn't get injurious, you know, from our point of view. In sort of reverse order of acute problems, they're attempting to establish a line of projection, a line of military projection across the Southern Pacific, right? We have a pretty good line of military projection across the Northern Pacific from Hawaii to the Marianas, Guam, et cetera. Mm-hmm. They're trying to do that across the South, and they're making good headway. So we've seen just this week, Nauru, and now it looks like Tuvalu will drop Taiwan in terms of diplomatic recognition and shift to China. We've seen large-scale economic investment. We've seen bribery. We've seen all sorts of things. We've seen the security presence in Solomon Islands. We're watching China build out what can only be assumed to be a dual-use presence in, I'm spacing the name of it, a tiny little island in the Central Pacific. But anyway, we're building out a kind of a line of access across the Pacific. Perfectly natural thing for them to do. They have vast trade stakes in the flow of goods across the Pacific, but worrying from our vantage point. Second, obviously, we're seeing them use a degree of economic and diplomatic coercion to kind of pressure states in the region to accept their point of view on Taiwan and other things. We've seen this extensively with Australia. We're watching it with the Philippines. We've seen it with the Japanese, although that's much harder for the Chinese to accomplish. And most worryingly, we're watching a military buildup, and specifically a naval buildup and a naval missile interplay buildup, which looks very much like it's designed to support a military move on Taiwan. We don't know what the time frame for that is. We don't know if they're going to do it. My assumption is they haven't made the decision to do it, but they're clearly building up the military capacity to do it. And that, I think, will be an acute challenge in, you know, X years, whether X is 1, 2, 5, I don't know. And in fact, I would stake a lot on the statement that they don't know, that they haven't made a decision yet as to the time frame for tackling Taiwan militarily. But unquestionably, they are building themselves the military capacity to do it. So all of those things are problematic. What they're doing to the Indians on the Himalayan border is problematic. I mean, there are a lot of things they're doing in the region that are making people worried. And their behavior in the South China Sea and the East China Sea is extremely aggressive. Vis-a-vis the Philippines, vis-a-vis the Australians, you know, they haven't done aggressive things to the Americans yet, but they certainly do risk-taking things to the Americans. And between national laws and the deployments and the use of their Coast Guard and their maritime militias, they are steadily building up a pattern of exerting dominance over those waters as distinct from operating a kind of, the standard, internationally standard, free flow of commerce, law of the sea kind of approach to those waters. They're operating in ways that look like they're trying to establish dominance of those waters. These are waters that hold 50% of world trade. This is not a minor body of water in which they're acting.
Fair enough. But yeah, I guess the question is, you know, isn't there a tendency here to translate capacity into intent? Okay, so China has built up and is building up its military. the United States has a significant presence in terms of this area. And, you know, the question then becomes, you know, what are the consequences? You look at the United States, it's added, you know, the Quad, it's developing its own, presumably enhanced capacity. Isn't that, you know, aren't we kind of misplacing, you know, the building of the capacity to the intent to do X, whatever the X is?
Yeah. I mean, all of international relations is the answer to this question, right? I mean,
true. Sure. Good point.
Of course we are, as have states through history, right? Yeah. And the Chinese look at us and think, oh my God, the Americans are going to come and invade us or cut off our supply lines. So let's build a navy to stop them. And we look at them. But all of human history is that. And the kind of question is whether we can establish a kind of a set of understandings, a set of regimes, a set of arrangements that can keep us from actually translating that capacity into war fighting, right? That's what we want to avoid. We don't want to end up fighting a war with the Chinese. And that's going to take a lot. The Chinese could make this an awful lot easier if they would, you know, eschew claims to Taiwan. That would go a long way to easing tensions in the Western Pacific, I can tell you. We could just say, oh, screw it, abandon the Western Pacific and walk away. I think it's highly unlikely that we would do that. It's highly unlikely we're not going to continue to want to have a stake in the security of the flow of 50% of world trade, half of it by very close allies of ours. I think it's unlikely we're going to just walk away from the Western Pacific. Mm-hmm. As long as they're there and we're there, there's going to be tensions. Now, I wrote a book about this stuff a couple of years ago, and I hinted at the possibility that we could end up in a place I refer to as mutually assured denial. You know, they can deny us the ability to choke off the South China Sea now, but we can deny them the ability to choke off the South China Sea. So if both of us can deny the other's capacity to choke it off, maybe we can end up in a kind of new form of MAD where, you know, we both rely on that commerce. A war would be devastating. They have enough military power to stop us from invading them or choking off that trade. We have enough military power to stop them. Maybe there's a stability to be negotiated there, but we don't have it yet. And what we're watching in their behavior, you know, you talk about intent. So we have to read what signals we can on the intent. Look at the way they treat the Philippines. Look at the way they harass Filipino Coast Guard and Filipino shipping. Look at the passage of the national maritime laws over those waters. I mean, there are whole hosts of behaviors that signal intent, which is hardly stabilizing. Now, is it an intent to invade Taiwan? We don't know. But it's certainly, I mean, I think the evidence is overwhelming that the intent is to establish a form of dominance in those waters. And, you know, if this is some backwater that would just happen to be in their border, fine. But it isn't. It's the world's, you know, this economic center of gravity. The 50% of world trade flows through those waters. It's going to be very hard for other nations to sort of accept China establishing dominance on those in those waters.
Yeah. And I did want to ask that. I mean, what have been the consequences for a number of those countries, let's say, you know, the Philippines and Vietnam, et cetera, Australia, for that matter? You know, how are they reacting then to what you see as this growing rivalry and, you know, threats of domination, certainly that have increased, you know, vis-a-vis from China in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, Japan too, for that matter.
Well, I mean, I think we're seeing several things. One, there's a reason that the Australians signed AUKUS, right? There's a reason they want nuclear submarines. Two, there's a reason the Japanese are increasing their defense budget substantially. And passing new laws that allow them to do things like interdict missiles over flying their territory. There's a reason the Philippines have welcomed the reopening of American naval bases on their territory. Okay. There's a reason the Vietnamese have signed a strategic cooperation agreement with the United States. So the region is nervous as hell about China. And are acting in ways that show that, with defense spending, with new strategic arrangements with the United States, new defense arrangements with the United States. Japan has signed a new arrangement with Britain to allow Britain to access their bases. So there is this kind of building up of alliance and alliance-like arrangements and defense arrangements around China. And of course, China is going to look at this, is looking at this, and sees encroachment and encirclement. And so they're going to want to build up more, right? And we are in an arms race. That's what we're in. And it doesn't do us any good not to acknowledge that we're in it. But we've been in arms races before, and they don't have to end in war, right? The issue, from my mind, is this is why I think of it as the management of strategic rivalry. If we don't acknowledge that we're in an arms race, if we don't acknowledge how dangerous the situation is, we're not going to focus on managing it. And we need to, because we are in a very dangerous situation.
Well, two things then. Okay, it makes sense. You clearly indicate both countries, both China and the United States, are very concerned about global commerce and the freedom of global commerce, because they both countries and those close to them rely on it. So what are the consequences? What, you know, in terms of this interaction between the desire for global commerce and freedom versus this rivalry in the context of certainly what you've pointed out, the Philippines and the South China Sea. I don't quite understand, you know, that seeming contradiction between one and the other.
Yeah. So what I did in the book is I tried to trace this historically, because I think it sort of helps to understand how it evolves.
Okay.
And I think this evolves essentially. It starts in the 80s and in the 90s when China begins opening up to foreign investment and to trade into the West, right? And very quickly becomes a major hub of global commerce and of global trade. 90% of all global trade moves by sea. And so when we look at the Chinese boom, when we look at resource imports, when we look at the huge quantities of oil and minerals and food stocks that they imported, and we look at the huge surge in Chinese exports, the 2000s, et cetera, all of this is moving by sea. Okay. So the Chinese economy becomes hugely dependent on the flow of goods by sea. And Hu Jintao is the one who coins the term the Malacca Dilemma, because they're looking at this. They're looking at their dependence on flow of goods by sea, but they also look at the fact that those waterways are secured and controlled by the United States and its allies, right? And they recognize this dilemma that the more they grow economically, the more dependent they will be on the flow of goods by seas, and the more dependent they become on the U.S. Navy to secure those flow of goods by sea.
Mm-hmm.
All right. As I wrote in the book, you know, all they had to do at that point in time for us to live in a different future was trust the United States. But they don't trust the United States. Why should they? Why would they trust the United States not to choke off that trade in times of pressure? We spent a bunch of our time in that period of time writing about how to implement blockades. We implemented a blockade against the Japanese. It's how we defeated the Japanese in the Second World War, or started, you know, part of how we defeated them. So they look at the situation. They're hugely dependent on the flow of goods by sea. They don't have a Navy that matters. The United States controls those goods. That makes them incredibly uncomfortable. And they decide, yeah, we better build a Navy to protect that flow of trade. And they begin doing that. And they begin first by building up enough capacity to defend what they call the near seas, East China Sea, Yellow Sea, South China Sea, Taiwan Strait. Mm-hmm. But now they've gone a lot farther, and they have now the capacity to project power out into the far seas. And, you know, at that point, all we have to do is trust them. All we'd have to do is say, oh, I'm sure it's benign. I'm sure they have only positive intent, and all they're going to do is protect trade and never going to do anything negative with their Navy. That's all we had to do. But of course we didn't, because of course we don't trust them, and why would we? And so it is tragic, right? I mean, we both have these huge stakes at sea. We're both hugely dependent on these flows. In theory, we could be sort of joining forces on the protection of global commerce. And for a brief period of history in the early 2000s, we did look at the international response to the Somali piracy against trade. Big European and NATO response, but China participated, Russia participated, under coordination by NATO. That was the world then. But they've moved on. Look at their non-response in the Red Sea. They're not interested in cooperating with the United States on this stuff at this stage. And I'm not even sure we'd welcome them if they wanted to. So they have moved past the point of feeling like it's okay to rely on the United States to guarantee a free flow of commerce at sea. They want their own capacity to do it, therefore building a Navy, and we're reacting as is predictable. All of it made just hugely more complicated by the geographical position of Taiwan. Right. Everything that they're doing in naval terms is the same stuff as you need to do to invade Taiwan. And so it's very difficult to distinguish between the capacity they're building up for self-defense purposes, for trade protection purposes, for global power projection purposes, and to invade Taiwan. And it's very hard to draw distinctions about, you can use a destroyer for lots of purposes. You can use a warship for lots of purposes. Some of the stuff they're building really looks like it's only designed for Taiwan, but a lot of it is mixed use. But so it is this kind of tragic evolution, right? There were points in time when we could have seen a different future where we could have been collaborating to protect global trade. But that's sure not the path we're on now.
Okay, so that's not where we're going at this point in time. So two kind of final questions. One, Taiwan, recent election, DPP, competitor wins a third term for the DPP. Yeah. He was vice president. What are the immediate kind of consequences of that election, if any?
Well, I don't think it's the kind of thing where the election itself suddenly triggers some Chinese action.
Right.
We're going to see more continuity than anything else in Taiwan's policy vis-a-vis mainland China, one China policy, et cetera. But obviously, the election did not result in people coming into power in Taipei. They were interested in moving towards a different kind of process with the Chinese. And there were people in that election who were interested, right? So the Chinese were obviously watching very closely in that election, attempting to influence that election, and were hoping for a different result.
Mm-hmm.
So this the election doesn't foreclose the possibility of stability by any means. It doesn't trigger immediate instability, but it does continue us on a pathway where the Chinese do not see a ton of options ahead of them. And from what we know of Xi Jinping's thinking, it seems pretty clear that he has convinced himself and told sort of everybody that matters around him that quote unquote reunification of Taiwan is the thing that would cement his legacy as the third great leader of modern China. Mm-hmm. Don't walk away from that kind of thing lightly, leader in his position. I hope that he finds a way to convince himself that there are other things that matter more. I hope that he becomes convinced that doing it militarily would be too costly. I hope many of such things, but I fear that his calculations may be different. And so the onus, I think, is on the United States to be extremely clear in sort of deterrence terms that both the chances of military success are low and the economic consequences from the disruption of trade in those waters are extraordinarily high.
Mm-hmm.
And that therefore he should not contemplate it. I don't yet see the, frankly, seriousness of purpose. It's not that the individual people involved aren't serious about this in the United States side. It's that we haven't sort of managed to go from a lot of people being serious about this to actually buying the right kinds of boats and weapon systems and building more boats and doing the things that would actually convince him that we were serious. And the risk is that he looks at us, thinks we're not serious, thinks we won't respond, acts, we do respond, and then we're in deep, deep, deep trouble.
But I mean, you're not suggesting for the U.S. a change in the so-called one China policy?
No, I am not.
Okay.
I'm suggesting that we, when there are all these calls for, let's sort of say we will come to Taiwan's defense. It was, to my mind, it was the classic version of talk loudly and carry a small stick, which historically has not been a wise strategy. Right? I would much rather we had a much larger stick and shut up, stay mute or opaque or unclear, as is our policy as to whether we would come to their defense, but have the actual shipbuilding program, the actual merchant marine capacity, the actual missile stockpiles, to suggest to Xi Jinping that if he were to come, he would lose.
Fair enough. One last area of kind of interaction here. And that, you know, you've talked about the military dimensions, the commerce dimension, but I wanted to raise at least with you, and particularly the military dimension, you mentioned AUKUS and you mentioned I mentioned the Quad. But the Biden administration initiative called IPEF, right? That's the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework discussions. Yeah. Yeah. And this is obviously trained towards allies and partners. This IPEF has 14 parties negotiating around pillars, four different pillars: trade, supply chains, clean energy, tax, and anti-corruption. But it's become clear that the Biden administration is not prepared to move forward on trade. And essentially, if I may be mistaken, you can correct me, but, you know, basically has shut that down. So what are the consequences of that, of trying to, you know, reach out to partners and allies, and at the same time making it clear that, you know, trade policy is basically off the table?
I mean, I think off the record, every senior person in the administration would recognize that it's distinctly suboptimal, right? At the very least, if they could accomplish it domestically, if they thought it would do good things domestically, they would go for trade. They would go for TPP and some other things, but right. They don't can be accomplished domestically. And to give them a little bit more credit than that, they also look at, you know, the long last couple of decades of globalization and see that it's had some pretty deleterious impacts in the American middle class, which have some pretty deleterious impacts in American politics. Right? One person who's was senior in the Hillary Clinton campaign and is senior in the administration now said to me, if we went for TPP, the Democratic Party would be run by the round Trump. In other words, they worry that if they go for trade liberalization, they would lose control of the Democratic Party to a kind of populist mm-hmm. force. The Republican Party has been lost to populist forces, and that would be dangerous. So, you know, they have real reasons for this. The effects of trade is not only trade, it's technology, a whole bunch of things, but hasn't been particularly good for the American middle class. And so, on the one hand, I can understand why they prefer to focus on rebooting American middle class economics, of which they're having some success. And on the other hand, it unquestionably weakens us in our negotiations with the allies. I think if I put myself in their shoes, they see things like AUKUS and the Japanese defense budget and the new Japanese arrangements for British ships being in their bases and et cetera, and think, you know, in the end, they would love the trade stuff, but they need our missiles and our ships more. And so they're going to still be willing to work with us on the things that matter most to us, even though we can't do the trade stuff now. And IPEF is a way of trying to kind of, you know, do something in the economic space, even though they can't get trade done per se. So it's suboptimal, and it weakens us. I don't think it weakens us catastrophically, given the way China's behaved. If China had played its cards differently in the past 5 years, okay, we might be in a different place. But China has chosen to, you know, swing hard into kind of coercive, economic and diplomatic coercion over the last several years, and lost a lot of ground with the Germans, with the Indians, with the Japanese, all sorts of people. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think it'll be an interesting thing historically, assuming we're all still alive, to look back and try to figure out why. Was it just domestic politics? Were there other things that caused Xi to, what I think we can say, is miss a serious opportunity of the Trump administration and this phase in international politics to play a more sort of constructive global leadership kind of approach, which he seemed to start the Trump era by doing. You know, everybody's forgotten now, but if you go back and read his speech at Davos just after Trump was elected, it was the, we are the leaders of globalization now, come join us in this search for growth, right? And all mm-hmm. of that sort of fell away towards coercion and sort of coercive diplomacy and economic coercion, et cetera. And I, you know, as I say, I think it'll be interesting to look back historically and to wonder why he did that and to see it as a missed opportunity. But we are where we are.
Fair enough. I want to say, I mean, it's been a pleasure talking to you, because we get both big picture and also more intimate kind of relations of the U.S.-China relations and more broadly in the Indo-Pacific. So I want to thank you, Bruce, for joining us in this discussion.
Pleasure to be here.